welcome to iDeveloper Live. We've been having more technical problems, but it wouldn't be iDeveloper Live without technical problems, and it's all related to that piece of string here in TechBree that we call bandwidth. Now, I am Scotty, here on iDeveloper Live in the TechBree studios, in this place that is just the height of technology, which means we can stream it full HD and full stereo Blu-ray quality video and sound across the internet from where we are. Or of course it might be slightly better if I kept taking photos and popping them in the post to everybody, but with me here, well, not here, but 8,000 miles away, and I'm sure looking as beautiful as ever, but we can't see him today, Mr. John Fox. How are you, Mr. John Fox?
I'm dandy as I want to be.
That's good. Well, I am glad that you are dandy, because dandy is what we need. And also with me today is a man who we have been threatening to bring on for a long, long time. From Rem Objects, please welcome Mr. Mark Hoffman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
That was enthusiastic, John. Well done.
Thank you.
Based on the fact that it looks like nobody in the chat room can actually hear us, this is a live show for just the three of us, by the signs of it today. Okay, so Mark, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, basically, I'm chief architect at Rem Object Software, and we develop components and frameworks and tools for software developers for macOS and iPhone, and also for other platforms. And I live in Berlin, Germany, and this is the first time on this show, so if you have any questions about me.
Want to know about that hat that you're wearing in the photo that Scotty has put up.
Where I actually got that in Tijuana, Mexico, 2005, I believe.
And so that was the arrest photo?
Actually, I don't know what exact photo you're looking at, because I'm pretty much wear the hat on all my photos. But
oh no, okay. You can arrest it in places.
Yeah, I can. I can't really comment on that.
It's the one that we pinched from the Rem Objects website. So the black and white one of you looking quite stern, actually.
I try, yeah.
There we are. Right, okay, well, we would normally at this point in the day, I don't think he's online again, because I believe, do you know what, I didn't know this was possible, but it is rumoured that Mr. Simon Wolfe has an even lower bandwidth than me at the moment, which means he is currently unable to listen to the show. Live in any form. That's right, because we're currently unable to broadcast it, so it doesn't make a lot of difference. I think even though he's not here, we should definitely do a Simon Wolfe welcome. But for those who can see, we have realised that there is a similarity. So, John, if we could just give the Simon Wolfe welcome. There we are, and we have decided that yes, Simon Wolfe is Steve Ballmer. Yeah, if you just take Simon Wolfe's beard away and take the glasses off, and you know, don't you think, you know, that jumper looks right, the shirt looks right, the whole rawr is good.
Stunning.
It is.
And so, you know, I've never seen the two of them in the same room at the same time. So.
No, nor have I, you see. And I do know that Simon Wolfe does regularly say developers. I've heard him do it when he thinks no one's listening. So, yeah, there we are. I think there we are. Simon, we know that you develop Mac software in your spare time now, because you spend the rest of your day making Microsoft the wonderful company that it is. Oh, and of course, that means that Simon spent $8.5 billion last week, which is quite impressive.
And still, despite the $8.5 billion spent on Skype, we still haven't been silenced, so.
No, there we are. But so we are waiting for the day when we can't hear each other either. Right, okay, other than the fact that do you know, someone said somewhere, I can't remember where I read this, that Microsoft spent $8.5 billion on Skype, and if they'd... they could have bought Apple for that 7 years ago. For half of that 7 years ago. So, what does that say to you?
No one expected Apple to be where they are.
Indeed. Okay. Yeah.
So do you think, based on that growth, that Skype will be worth, something like, $400 billion in 8 years' time?
Yeah. Well, not that Obama is managing it, sure. Okay. Right?
Yes. Simon Wolf is now managing Skype. Steve Ballmer. We get this mixed up. Okay, let's actually get on to something that's a little bit more serious concerning news this week. John, do you want to deal with this one? Because it's all to do with patents and whatever else. And I think you've been following it maybe a little closer than I have.
Yeah, so there's a company called Lodesys LLC, which is a patent licensing company that sent out some lovely FedEx envelopes to a number of third-party developers, anybody who basically has in-app purchasing on iOS, saying that, hello, you're using one of our patents. Please buy a license for it. And so that's going to make for a very interesting WWDC. They put it out there, and there was a kind of a firestorm on Twitter and on blogs. And then they've since put up a blog post with a fact. And so, where they're basically saying, no, this is just like, they were trying to build the metaphor of going to stay in a hotel and saying, well, of course, the architect and the people who supply the hammers and the nails all expect to get paid. And it's no different from people who have patents. And, even though the patent was done a long time ago and is very broad, it's very easy to say in retrospect, that this is the obvious thing. But back then it wasn't. And we have the patent and you guys are going to pay for it. And that's as much as I know right now. I know that some of our friends of the show, like Mr. Freeman, received one. He tweeted it. So I'd be curious to know how they went about finding the developers that they wanted to send notice to. Did they just basically go through and find out every app that has in-app purchasing and send it to that? Or did they make it a kind of beauty contest? And Jonathan Freeman was one of the top developers and who they
were. Well, I think in one of the posts they actually said that, quote-unquote, some of our favorite apps – app developers have been sent mail, so maybe they just went by the apps they actually owned.
Oh, well, it's very kind of them. So at least they sent them a little bit of money before they asked for it back.
So, I mean, how does this work? Because actually, I read, I think, today that actually for anybody to actually sign the agreement and pay the money would then be in contradiction with Apple's own publishing agreement that they're in, and therefore they get disqualified from being in the store.
Yeah, I mean, there's been that's certainly one of the arguments, and then the classic thing when you're a patent troll is that you're just looking for any type of legal precedent. In other words, it doesn't matter the size of the company that you get to do a licensing. Somebody's paid you a license, then you go to another court and they can say, look, we have agreements from these companies. I saw this back in the desktop publishing days a million years ago when Linotype Hell, who owns so many patents on anything related to that, went after tiny, tiny developers saying, you're using our technology, and they had a broad patent portfolio. I think that other people have said, who knows, maybe it's somebody who wants to spread FUD about being an Apple developer, that here you are and this 30% certainly for the publishing world has had some controversy. I think people who are doing app development haven't really complained about the 30% cut. But if you can't do in-app purchasing or there's some lack of clarity around that, that seems a little bit concerning. And I don't know where they are right now, but there was one among their frequently asked questions like, well, doesn't this also concern Windows 7 and Windows Mobile and Android developers? And they said yes, but they haven't gone after them yet, which maybe because there's who knows, but
all three of them.
It's yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think isn't it the thing that well. From what I understand, most Android developers who are making any money are making it from just straight advertising, not from necessarily from in-app purchasing.
Yeah, I think so, from what people say.
Yeah.
So,
the one other thing that I read that was interesting was that they said, well, why, shouldn't Apple be the one that buys this on behalf of their developers? And from what they said, Apple has bought it for, and I didn't understand the term. They bought it for their nameplate applications, and so what that means, that, in other words, Apple paid it for what? For iBooks or something? You can get a free application, and it is that's not an in-app purchase, is it? I guess it is.
So basically, if Apple have made a payment to somebody, is that Apple saying, well, actually, yeah, that yeah, these guys are right and you've got to pay it? If they're making the payment on their apps, are they saying that other vendors should be making the payment? Is that what Apple is saying?
Well, I could assume that Apple, I mean, assuming it's true that Apple paid them and licensed something, it could be that Apple licensed it from them under the assumption that they would license the whole thing for iOS and developers could use it, and now lots of sort of changed the terms around on underneath them, something like that.
Well, but they weren't very clear about which of their patents in their portfolio
right.
Apple licensed, because I know that you know, companies regularly patent and buy patent portfolios, and it's kind of a mutually assured destruction
right.
technique that's used. And so it might very well be, since Lotus says, hey, this is one of many patents that they have, that Apple licensed a patent for something else that was in their portfolio, and they're spinning that into meaning that they bought the
system. I know, but I think they made it sound like, okay, Apple did license it, but you guys got to license it separately. I mean, that's from what I took away from reading those blog posts earlier today. I mean, I could be wrong. I mean, obviously, I mean, they did some obscure playing with those names there, and some legalese with whatever was licensed. But that's what I understood from what they said. And I mean, of course, it would make little sense for Apple to purchase this and to license this and expect developers to do it, because A, they probably wouldn't have mentioned this. They would have mentioned this, and B, why would Apple license it? Because they're not really doing any in-app purchases themselves, are they? I mean, unless you want to like count the App Store itself as doing in-app purchases.
Well,
right?
But isn't iBooks an in-app purchase? So it's hard to say. I mean, is iBooks an in-app purchase, or is the purchase going through, you know, the iTunes Music?
I guess that really goes depends on how you want to define in-app purchase. I mean, the App Store itself could be in-app purchase, right? I mean, buying something on Amazon in your web browser could be an in-app purchase, since it's an app.
Yeah, they should go after Netflix.
Exactly. Yeah.
So are they saying the very concept of purchasing something from within an application has been patented?
Well, I think they said it was patented, but...
Yeah, well, you know what I mean, but they can't speak properly either. I know everyone's going to say, but isn't that just, you know, you can't... I thought, you know, this was about specific technology, not general principles, because the action of buying something from within something is, you know, how can you patent that?
Well, I guess it's one of the main problems people have with patents, right? That, I mean, not really that companies patent stuff, but companies patent stuff that's so blatantly obvious and that they get granted the patent on stuff like, I don't know, clicking a button, things like that.
Well, I think the other thing that Lotus was doing is they're saying, look, you know, the question was something like, well, isn't this kind of a snotty, nasty way to get, you know, money for your patents? I guess yes, but it's the only way that we know of, essentially. It's like, you know, and that's why we're trying to make it very easy for you. You know, they're trying to come off and saying, look, we've done all this work, you know, and I'm trying to think, well, what work is it that Lotus themselves does? Because the company's not, if I understand correctly, they are a patent clearinghouse.
Well, supposedly they bought it from some guy they mentioned on the blog that works for him. I forgot the name. So, I mean, whatever work that guy did, I don't know, think really hard for 5 minutes. Or...
Yeah.
But it still doesn't make sense, because basically they, you know, it's... They're not going to come through this. They might make a few bucks now, but basically they're screwed, aren't they? I mean, who is ever going to do any business with them or anything of any type ever? It's like when GIFs or GIFs or whatever you want to pronounce them
right,
became
yeah.
this paint stuff. I mean, yeah, it's basically these guys are a bunch of, you know, trolls after, you know, just trying to earn money without actually having any intelligence, cleverness, or the ability to make anything themselves, but just to try and scab it off somebody else.
Yeah, but I mean, compared to the GIF patent, I mean, that was an actual implementation of something. So in Unisys, I think, I don't know whether they owned it or, you know, created it or bought it, but I'm pretty sure that major develop, they did get some licensing fees from things. And you know, by comparison, it looks almost
indeed,
in many ways, no different from the MPEG LA group, right? I mean, it's like there was work that was done to develop all the patent pools for allowing, you know, online video that we all enjoy, and that, you know, you can argue about it, but I think that's a different type of thing, patenting an implementation of something versus just a mere idea. And as Spectre pointed out in the the chat rooms, like, you know, the concept of in-app purchasing that's existed for cable set-top box or kiosk at shows, you know, in stores even. So I don't know. I think that this is clearly something that they brought the pressure on the developers to make sure that, you know, the developers would in turn go to Apple and say, you know, what's going on here? Because even if there is money to be paid, and even if we wanted to do it, we can't without contravening the license terms that you're doing it. So it's pretty clear to me that Apple is going to do something to either, you know, drop a lawyer bomb on them or quietly give them some money under the table and say, we have a blanket license. Now, please, you know, drop
it. So that's the part I didn't understand when I read the stuff. So what's actually in the Apple agreement that prohibits people from paying that license fee to Luxus?
I think the point of it is that if you do in-app purchasing, the only people that benefit from the transaction is the developer and Apple, and that no other third party can be involved in the transaction.
Okay, so they're actually asking for a per transaction fee, not just like a global fee to license the technology. Okay. Yeah, Lotus
or Apple. I mean, yeah, Lotus. Well, they said that they have two formulas. So you say, you know, however you want to pay us is fine. You can either do a blanket statement, you know, a blanket flat fee, or you can do a percentage. So.
Oh, okay, but I mean
that Apple, this is all. Sorry,
but I mean that can't. I mean, I'm not saying people should do that, but I mean I don't see how the Apple agreement would prohibit that. I mean, if you sell something, you sublicense from someone else in your app. I mean, then you're selling something, and Apple gets a 30%, and you still pay a percentage to someone else as well, right? So I don't see how that conflicts with Apple's agreement. I mean, again, I'm not saying people should go out and humor Lotus and actually pay him. I'm just saying I don't really understand the
right. Well, I think a lot of, I mean, I, as everyone say, I have no idea.
I mean, the trouble is the patent law or patent law, whichever you, it wasn't designed for this age that we now live in. I think someone pointed out in the chat room just now that originally you couldn't actually, you know, patent anything to do with software, because software is just math and you can't patent math. You can only discover it is the statement Coco Samurai says out there. So it's interesting that, yeah, I think this just needs a big shake-up in law. I mean, they've gone after the App Store. Why? Because it's the ones with in-app purchases. And as you said, no one's buying Android or whatever else. And if they were, they'd go after it. But really, you know, something has to wake up here, because this is basically just going to destroy business at the end of the day. Either Apple are going to have to stump up a whole bunch of cash for something that actually, you know, no matter how vicious or whatever Apple might want to be, they shouldn't have to pay. All developers are just going to stop developing for the App Store.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean,
and then go flocking to Android. So I don't know. I mean, the valley is always full of all this intrigue, and there are two things that are going on that are kind of similar and interesting. That Facebook was caught, you know, running a kind of a PR campaign against Google. So, you know, we've seen kind of these little quiet campaigns more in the type of political world with push polls and things like that. You know, and this kind of dirty, you know, things seems to be coming more and more into the software world.
Yeah, it's putting a protection on you know, some sort of thing you've manufactured or something you've actually physically made or proven in a way is understandable, but to put it on an idea, that just doesn't make any sense to me at all. Doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, they patent gene forms for you know, genetically modified organisms. They're patenting that.
Well there we are.
Move on to things that are less far afield.
We're going to
let's talk about
that.
REM objects a little bit.
We showed it. Well, actually, we would often do a sponsorship section in the show, and I actually remember. And we would say REM objects, REM objects, REM objects. Everybody loves
REM objects.
Thank you, John, for catching up eventually. But we don't need to say that today, because Mr. REM objects is here himself, and so he can tell us all about it. And you know what? There's a good chance that he'll actually get the pitch right.
I don't know about that, but
compared to us, so there we are. So,
but I think you should be forced to say me, me, me. Everybody loves me.
I'm not sure if I should say that.
We want you to do that. Oh. There you are. You're not prepared to get out there and just and self promote yourself. I don't know. And they put you in charge of sales.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't know.
Well, actually, all joking aside, we've been meaning to get Mark on the show for a long, long time. And first of all, Mark, I am going to say a great big thank you. You sponsored every single episode of the MDN show. You would have sponsored every single episode of iDeveloper Live if I got life in order. But every single episode that's had a sponsor, you have been one of those sponsors. And so I would like the iDeveloper Live audience, all seven of them, to give you a big round of applause to say thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
There we are. Right, I said you can go away now. Oh, no. We actually want to talk to you. Okay, so we've been talking about RemObjects and the RemObjects SDK and Data Abstract for a couple of years, at least now, on these shows, but we've never actually sort of dug into them anymore what they are. So I don't know how you want to break this down, whether we're going to do one of those at a time or both of them. I leave that to you. So let's start with the 30,000-foot overview of what it is your products and RemObjects do.
Okay, so basically we've got a whole range of products, but I think the two we should talk about today is Data Abstract and RemObjects SDK, because those are the two where we have versions for Mac and iOS. And basically Data Abstract is a framework and a set of tools that allows people to build multi-tier database solutions. So basically anytime you have a client app on your iOS device or on your Mac and you want to talk to enterprise-type databases, like real databases, either in the cloud or running on servers somewhere in your company, then Data Abstract is the right solution to use for that, to build an application that can talk to that kind of database efficiently and securely, and that scales properly. And then RemObjects SDK sort of sits below Data Abstract and sits a subset of Data Abstract, and that can be used to develop and to talk to remote servers, be it web services or using other formats like JSON or XML RPC. You can build those servers and you can build clients that talk to those servers to communicate. And that's basically the 10,000 foot view.
So since you support all these different flavors of web services, I've always wanted to know, who is still using SOAP? I mean, I guess other than Microsoft.
Well, cool. Quite a few people are still using SOAP. I mean, it's basically like, I wouldn't tell people, if you build a service, I wouldn't tell them use SOAP to build it. But there's lots of services out there that use SOAP that you might want to talk to. And I mean, lots of them.
I don't doubt that there are lots of services out there. I guess what I meant is if you were constructing a new web service right now from scratch, are people still choosing to use SOAP?
Depends. I mean, I guess lots of people, at least on the Microsoft side, are using WCF, which pretty much boils down to SOAP. So SOAP is still pretty helpful if you want to talk to services like that, which people are still building those today. But I mean, if you were to ask me right now, what should I use to build a service, I'd say if you want to use our stuff completely, server and client side, we have our own sort of protocols that are binary and more efficient that you can use. I guess JSON otherwise is pretty common these days.
All right, so tell us more about the protocols there. Is a binary protocol better performance still than gzipped, JSON?
Right, I guess as far as the data on the wire is concerned, both are probably pretty equal, whether you gzip your JSON or you use the binary protocol, but you still got to go and parse the JSON. I mean, it's still plain text. You got to have code that, runs through, finds those little curly braces, and parses all the stuff together. Right. And the binary format we use, it's literally just the binary format. So if you send an integer, that's going to be those 4 bytes or those 8 bytes if it's an N64. Right. And if it's a string, then it's literally, the length and then those bytes. And there's no, there's no overhead, be it angle brackets and XML tags if you're using XML, or be it other JSON adornments around it.
So if I'm an Objective-C iOS or macOS developer, what do you recommend then? I mean, if somebody's saying, I just want the maximum possible performance because I'm doing lots and lots of transactions or lots and lots of data across, do you still recommend that people would use that? Or
basically what I would recommend is that if you have control over the entire chain, the client and the server, and no one else is going to access that with like third-party applications they're going to write, then I would recommend using our protocol. And if you want to open either the server or the client up to, talking to applications that other people might write, then you can also use both protocols at the same time so that your client could use the fast binary protocol, but your server is still open using, say, SOAP or JSON or even both. And then if third-party developers want to talk to your application, to your server, you can tell them, hey, you can use SOAP, you can use JSON, or you can even use RemObject's own binary format yourself if that's what you want to go with.
And so for people who want to deploy something on something like, Amazon EC2, if people are still not too squeamish about that, or do you have any support for saying here's a virtual machine disk image for that's all configured with the RemObject server stack?
Well, it sort of depends. I mean, if what kind of server you're building. I mean, if you want to build a database middle tier server, we've got some existing solution you can use, so you don't have to write your own server. But if you're writing, some other servers that perform some kind of operation, I mean, by definition, you want to write your own server, right? So they can't just be like an executable you just upload that's done for you. So basically, you would use our library to build the server executable and put your own logic in there and compile that and put that on the server.
So it's just linkable frameworks. I thought that there were some demons or things like that had it.
Well, on the service level, it's pretty much just linkable frameworks. As I said, I mean, on the database side, we've got sort of a reusable server that you can just put up and you can just load your definitions of how you want to publish data and how you want it accessed and what kind of business logic you want in place. You can just load that in on the database side. But on the service side, I mean, again, by definition, you got to write code somewhere to implement what you want, what your service to do, right?
Yeah. Now, and so when you've been with RemObject from day one,
I've been
did you join?
Co-founder.
Oh, okay. Wow. I have to show even more respect to the double hugs at WWDC. But did you guys? You had started off kind of in the Delphi world.
Yeah. So we pretty much started with both the SDK and then later Data Abstract for Delphi, and then a couple of years later we branched out to have the same products for .NET. And then I think it was 2 years ago, we basically added the third platform, and that's basically Data Abstract and the SDK for Xcode, which supports iOS and macOS.
And, you know, so Delphi was kind of squarely in the mission critical custom apps, right? And so it's corporate development for mostly for in-house use. And I think .NET is very popular.
Yeah, I mean, mostly enterprise development or in-house development these days,
right.
Yeah.
And so tracking the success or kind of the increased access of iOS and macOS in the enterprise, I mean, I think maybe not widely well known, but there's a fair amount of custom app development for enterprise that's going on in iOS.
Indeed,
these
days, yeah. And I think that's I mean, right now that's sort of the main audience for our products, people that already have a solution or are building a solution that's broader than just iOS. I mean, they might be building their own server and they might be building clients for Windows and for the Mac, and they also want to build an iOS client.
Mm. And is Apple helping you in any way? Or I know this is kind of more marketing and sales, but it's something I was always curious about. I mean, Apple, traditionally said, we're focusing on the consumer, but the consumer experience is so incredibly good that it's, it gets snuck in through the back door to enterprises. But every now and then I see some evidence that they say, wait, the things that we've done with iOS, make the phones, whatever, pass the checklist against BlackBerry and whatnot. So they do it, but then they have a number of clients in higher education and biotech and, who knows, maybe some financial services that they say, well, maybe it's now worth revisiting it. So does anybody at Apple kind of help you in any way?
Well, not directly, I suppose. But I mean, Apple has definitely been doing a lot. I mean, in both iOS 3 and 4, they had a lot of new features targeted at enterprise and making sure that their devices work well in enterprise scenarios. So, I mean, that's definitely given a big boost, I think, to people using iOS in wider deployments and building enterprise apps for them, and not just apps for the App Store, but I mean apps that they distribute internally for their enterprise, and that are specific solutions for what their enterprises need.
And for the types of applications that are being built, are there certain kind of sectors that stand out more? In other words, is it more financial services or more, is there a particular thing that saying, wow, that's what people are building with?
I couldn't really tell you, to be honest, because we don't really track that much, but it's pretty much spread all over. But it's really hard to put numbers or even like relative percentages on onto what kind of what kind of companies are building stuff. I mean, it's pretty much all over the place.
And did you notice that Scotty has come back? Scotty, are you here? Do you want to chime in?
I am here, and I have been listening, and I've been sort of just about coming up. Now, Mark, the question I want to
actually,
ask
you
about
you're
the
both kind of sort of darlinging because... there a little bit.
Started what? Well.
Oh, I'm darlinging.
Yeah, like, I mean, hey.
It's a Doctor Who term, John. Are you not a Doctor Who fan?
No. Sorry. Nice.
So you didn't know the term Dalek.
Never.
Shame on you.
Okay, I think John should go and just stick his head down the toilet and flush several times in repentance. Daleking, I can't believe that you... Okay, never mind. We're just going to move on. We're going to pretend that that moment of horror didn't happen. You've been... The OS X libraries were the sort of client libraries were the sort of later libraries that you've brought along. You know, just from a technical background point of view, how did you find writing the client side stuff that had to connect all this stuff in Objective-C compared to the experience you'd had writing the code in .NET or whatever you use on Linux? Is it mono? Did you go for Objective-C on mono on Linux? You might have just said in the interview, and I was dealing with technical problems. But in comparison, writing the Objective-C stuff to connect to your servers, how was that experience compared to what it was on other platforms?
Well, my personal opinion is that I love it. I mean, I tell you, usually tell people I haven't had this much fun coding in 10 years. So, I mean, I really love working with Objective-C and Cocoa and all the frameworks. I know it's really been a really enjoyable experience compared to, I know, everything I did for the previous, I don't know, 10 or so years. I mean, it might have been Delphi and .NET. I mean, they're all great tools, don't get me wrong. And I like working with them, but I really enjoy Xcode and Objective-C. So that's been really... fun.
Have your customers who were Delphi, I mean, if you came from the Delphi world and .NET, have then your customers and said, okay, now we are going to do some desktop and iOS stuff. Have they asked you, help us, you know, transition to Objective-C and the Apple developer tool chain? In others, have you been able to be a kind of a, you know, iOS?
I think so. I mean, there's definitely lots of existing customers that are starting. I mean, I guess it's sort of like split. I know maybe not quite half, but like 60-40 or so existing customers who sort of add iOS or add the Xcode platform. I don't know what they're doing necessarily iOS or Mac, but I mean, I'm guessing most are doing iOS. So existing customers that are adding that to the project they already have, or at least to the creating a new project based on already knowing data abstract for, say, .NET or Delphi. And then, of course, there's also new developers who come in and just do the iOS side or just the Xcode side.
Are you aware of anybody who has tried to use, now I'm forgetting, I'm spacing, you know, not GNU Step, but the Cocotron. Have you ever heard of anybody trying to write an Objective-C app using data abstract?
I'm not aware of that,
no.
And
deploy it to on Windows?
I think that's a bit out there, John.
Yeah.
anybody writing any app in Cocotron?
Yeah. I never really looked at those tool chains, but I'm from what I understand, I think they just have a pretty basic foundation level, but like just the basic classes and Objective-C runtime stuff. So I'm not even sure if our frameworks don't depend on things that just aren't there. Like, I mean, if there's no NS URL connection or no, I know, NS predicate or whatever, things that we use internally, then...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's actually gotten a little bit further from that. I mean, it is a curiosity. I mean, it's hard to imagine why somebody, you know, who the reason you'd want to do it, I think, is if you were, you know, just hardcore Objective-C and if you wanted to reach Windows and you had no interest in learning .NET, that you might say, well, it's possible to do. I mean, the only kind of commercial thing that I was aware of is, I forgot the name of the developer, but basically he had a Mac client. It was for sharing things, right? So he built a basic thing that you could select files and that you could then transfer to your iOS device. And he had lots of people saying, we want it for Windows. And he was trying to figure out how to do it. And he actually did use Cocotron for doing it. So, you know, laid out the UI and interface builder and built it with Xcode and deployed it. And his experience was that, you know, it worked. I had to do a lot of, you know, work to contribute to it, but it wasn't an impossible thing to do. And I think he was happy he did it. So, but that was also a number of years ago. And I know it's been kind of a silly dream for a long time. At this point, my own personal take is if you wanted to reach Windows, you'd be better off writing a web app and deploying it.
Probably,
in
yeah. So, I mean, basically, all we build upon is Foundation. So we don't use, I know, Cocoa Touch or Cocoa or any sort of advanced frameworks. So, I mean, assuming that Foundation framework is sort of complete or complete enough on Cocotron or GnuStep, then I think Data Abstract should work. But it's certainly not something we're going to, I don't know, support officially at this stage, I think.
Yeah. My son is trying to steal my iPad from me, and I'm trying to explain to him that he can't have the iPad because Daddy actually needs it today at work.
Yeah. Mark, forgive me if you've already answered this question, because I was trying to deal with some technical problems while John was asking you. So if you've already answered it, just say yes. But I mean, Data Abstract with this offlining, you know, how are you doing that? You know, can you explain what's going on behind the scenes to us?
Okay, so basically, as I said before, I mean, Data Abstract uses the multi-tier data access approach. So you don't really talk directly to the backend database, but you talk to a middle tier that sort of has control over what tables you talk to and how to package the data that you get back from it. And the way this works is that you make a call to the middle tier and you ask for a complete table or a subset of a table, either by name or by a query, and then you get that data to the client. And at that stage, you sort of offline by default, meaning you can work with the data without really having a connection to the server. And it's only when you make changes and you later want to apply them back to the server that you got to talk to the server again. So what Data Abstract sort of contains is something we call briefcases, where it allows you to take that entire local state and just shove it into a file when your application quits or when your application goes to the background, so you can later reload it again and sort of start in the same position, including having all the data and having all your changes that you might have made but not sent to the server, and all of those are persisted. And then once you have a connection again, you can package that whole thing up again and send it back to the server.
And everything just works perfectly?
Usually.
No, well, that's tricky. That's an interesting thing, because there's been lots and lots of discussions about how to do this type of offline and synchronization stuff. So,
I think the big difference, I mean, I was listening to a podcast the other day where they were talking about the difference. I think it was Hypercritical. The difference between how Apple does syncing and Google does syncing, about whether you consider the server your one point of truth and then the clients get data, or whether you consider your client, each client sort of is its own set of truth and you got to sort of get them to fit together. And I think Data Abstract sort of uses the server model, where basically you have your data in the server and then each client gets the data and makes the changes and sends those changes back to the server. And then the server has to work out, I don't know, who changed what. And that makes it a lot easier that if two people change the same thing, you're gonna have some sort of conflict resolution, right? So what usually happens is the second client that sends a change is gonna get a rejection and say, hey, I can't change this record because I know this other guy already changed it. What do you want to do with that? So I mean, there's a certain level of handling you have to do for those kind of scenarios, but it's usually pretty easy to deal with that.
If the server is the central source of truth, yeah. It's something that I've been thinking about, and I haven't come to any final conclusions about it. But you know, with Memory Miner, one of the ideas that I've had for the longest time, and hopefully this year, at least towards the end of the year, I'll have some functionality in there after my third or fourth try. But you have a lot of people who are trying to annotate the same set of photos because you want multiple voices on it, right? You know, both literally voices where you might record something, and voices in terms of commentary and recollections. And it's less a problem of trying to say who has the definitive answer or something than it is just to be able to identify who said what and to be able to display a stream and everybody being able to see the stream. And so it's kind of like more like in some ways, just threaded commentary, threaded annotations, but that everybody who makes some type of contribution has to go up to the server and then just be able to have the client kind of see.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example to show the difference, really. I mean, if you think about it, let's assume you have like five different sort of client islands where you sort of create your threads, and then later you move them up to the server. That means that the server has to like merge the entire thing into one big thread, right? But if basically the truth is on the server and every client just sends their stuff to the server, then it's the server can just add them to the list as they come in, right? I mean, obviously, I mean that's pretty simplified scenario compared to something where you can actually have conflicts, but it sort of illustrates how one thing, even for the simple case, looks a lot more complicated than the other. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think that there's the technical side of it, and then there's the UI portion of it. You know, if you do have to do conflict resolution, how do you
present
it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like there's nothing worse than saying there's a conflict. It's right down to the original DOS messages, you know, or early Windows messages, like, you know, your computer has performed an illegal operation. SWAT teams are arriving.
And I mean, how you would handle that, I mean, obviously depends a lot on what kind of application you're writing, right? I mean, the simplest case, you could just say, I don't know, whoever made the change last wins. Or, I mean, you could just say, hey, this already changed. You want to use this or that. Or in more complicated cases, you might actually like have to, I don't know, present like a view with the differences. Like, I don't know, say in the address change and you have conflicting changes, you might actually want to show both addresses next to each other and tell the user, hey, pick and choose which fields you want, right? I mean, it all depends on what level of data integrity you have or you need, and also what level of sophistication you expect from your user in handling that kind of problem, right?
Have you guys ever thought about doing any type of hosted service? I know that, or is it just that, you know, the types of things people want to do is so wildly different one from the other that's not worth it?
We certainly thought about it, but we haven't really, I don't know, never gotten to any concrete plans, because right now we're in the business of developing software that we sell to people, and once you get into hosting, that's sort of a whole different kind of business. Which, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad business or not a business worth getting into. I'm just saying it's that's a whole different set of, I don't know, considerations you got to apply to, like, I don't know, in terms of uptime guarantees and.
Oh, but it's so easy. You just throw everything up on EC2 and S3.
Exactly. Yeah, because we know that EC2 never goes down ever.
No, that's right.
Well, actually,
I was slightly distracted, John, because in the Skype chat room, apparently Natasha Pekina is telling me that she could be my premium Russian bride if I really wanted her to be.
Oh, that's awesome!
And I was just trying to weighing up whether that was something I was interested in or not. Actually, I'm far more interested in the in discussing distributed data technology than some beautiful Russian
I'm glad
bride.
To hear that.
Why don't you bring her into the conversation, see what her opinions are. Ask her whether she believes the single source of truth should be on the server.
Okay, I will do that while I'm just doing here. Okay, I will type that in a moment. Mark is hopefully answering this next question. When I, as a developer, when I come to write an application that's going to be distributed, now we have Data Abstract, or we might be going for the RemObjects SDK if we're looking just more about connections. That gives me access to remote data and briefcasing. But what should I be thinking about in the way that I design my application because it's going to be distributed that will be different to designing it from just being a client-server app? I mean, you know, for an example, do I have to consider, you know, the volume of data I'm going to be getting, or is Data Abstract going to sort of automatically sort that out for me? You know, or do I have to make sure my queries are nice and small, or stuff like that? You know, can you give me some examples of the sort of things I need to be thinking to develop a distributed application as opposed to a local or client server?
Well, actually, you shouldn't really be doing anything different, because you shouldn't really be writing client server applications in this century in the first place. I mean, yeah, I mean, you do sort of have to plan a little bit ahead in terms of, I mean, especially on the iPhone, when you're developing for the iPhone or the iPad, you got to sort of plan for the smaller device factor, right? So, I don't know, say you're writing a client that talks to your CRM database with, like, I don't know, millions of customers in there and, I don't know, 10 millions of products. You don't just want to download this whole thing to the client to work with that, because, I don't know, after a couple of minutes, it's just going to kill your app because you downloaded, I don't know, 20 gigs of data and they didn't fit in the memory, right? So you do sort of have to plan around the scenario that you have a small device and you only want to download the data that you actually want to work with. So I mean, for example, in a say, again, CRM application, you might not want to download the whole list of clients, but you want to, you might want to do like a search on request. So when the user starts typing in the name, then you send a request to the server downloading the subset of names that fit that request. And only when the user clicks on the actual name in the list, you go and download the whole record for that customer, simply because you couldn't fit the whole data for all your customers into memory.
Now I want to stay on that point for a second. That's interesting to me. So is there something in Data Abstract or in the server side that helps you hold onto a query that's in process so that it would allow you to do the kind of like Google live search? You know what I'm saying? Instead, you know, you type in a few characters, it sends a request to the server saying, please start matching at it, and they continue to type, and it kind of updates an in-progress.
Well, you sort of don't really want to do that because that basically goes back to scalability. I mean, ideally, you want to have you want to get rich, right? So you want to have like 10 million people using your app on the iPhone, right? So the last thing you want to do is when each of those 10 million people are typing a name, to have 10 million objects on your server running, each of them holding on to a query and like, I don't know, guessing on already having the data that you want to fetch next, right? So you really want to write your application statelessly, and that's sort of the model that the Data Abstract sort of leads you into. I mean, you can go out of your way and do it differently, but you really want basically every request to your server, you want to be independent of the previous request, because that allows you to scale much better, be it just by keeping the server load low, or also by having the first request go to server A and the second request go to server B, because server A got too busy in the 5 seconds in between, right?
Right, but have you followed or looked into how Google does that with the smart request, if that's what call them? Because that was something curious to me about how they were able to do that in some way. Is it just because, you know, they have such computing scale that it doesn't matter if there's a tiny little bit of state, or are they passing something back to the client saying, this is what we found so far, and if your subsequent request goes somewhere else?
Yeah, I would think, I haven't really looked at what Google does specifically. I mean, I assume you refer to the new live search or whatever they call it, right? Yeah.
Yes,
so I would assume they just send the request every time you type. So when you hit, I know, I, they send I, and when you set the D, and then there's a D, and when you type developer, they send I developer. I mean, basically key by key, or maybe with a certain delay, so they only send like when you stop typing for 10 milliseconds or whatever. But I would be pretty surprised if they actually keep state on the server to do that.
So then the other question I had is in-memory data structures. Like, for instance, you're doing geo queries or things like that, where you've got things that are would be slow with traditional SQL requests. Are there tools that you have that says if you've got a fairly complicated data structure, we can now put it all into memory and make your queries never have to touch the database?
Well, Data Abstract is really all about the database. So basically, it exposes the data sort of in your tabular format as you would expect from a database. So it doesn't really do any kind of ORM mapping or anything of those sorts, if that's what you're asking. But of course, I mean, if you have like say a database server that can work with geolocations, like I think SQL Server 2008 has that, where you can say, give me all the rows that fall into a radius of 5 miles within this point, things like that. Then of course you could pass those type of queries through to your SQL Server to basically have that calculation happen inside the server based on the advanced knowledge that the server has about this. But of course, at that stage, you're sort of tying yourself to a specific database, right? But
right. Interesting. I mean, it's another thing that I've been struggling with memory miner, and I've heard different suggestions. One are to use a geo aware database server, because MySQL also has some things, and even SQLite, there's some code I've seen there where you can actually write in C a kind of. It is a stored procedure of sorts to speed those things up. But what I'm interested in is being able to do correlations using time and place. And it's a tricky thing to bring to scale. Hmm. And one suggestion I had from somebody saying, look, you could distribute multiple servers and they could all have multiple copies of the data. And you could even have a central database that has, this is all the data that we do have, and replicate that data to multiple machines, that could handle the request statelessly, but you could outfit the machines with enough memory that you could hold a huge volume of data in memory and not have to do any lookups, not ever have to hit the database for any normal request. I thought that was an interesting suggestion.
I mean, our usual approach to that is, I mean, the database server is pretty much made for getting data and getting it to you quickly, right? So early on with DA, we had lots of, we investigated into like, you know, caching data locally in the middle tier rather than going to the backend server every time to get the data and all that. But it really turned out that there was very little, if anything, to be gained from that, because again, the database server is made for getting a SQL statement and getting you the resulting data as quickly as possible. I mean, assuming it's properly optimized and everything. So that usually works pretty well without, you know, trying to artificially hold stuff in memory, because then you're just sort of replicating the data. I mean, you might just write your own database server, right? Because essentially you're using the database as a cheap, I don't know, file storage, loading all your data on storage, right, and then you do all this stuff yourself. I mean, that doesn't really make sense, because, I mean, there's, I don't know, lots of smart people getting paid lots of money to write database servers and get the algorithms just right.
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny, because in the early days of you know, when I was writing web objects applications a million years ago, you try to, they were doing everything they could to avoid round trips to the database server. And I could never figure out why it was. Was it because, you know, back then the network bottlenecks or how fast something could come back? And you, it's just as you said, you basically are trading one set of problems for the other, because then you would have, you know, editing context in memory in a session, or even not in a session, in an application instance, being out of sync with the truth of another app instance that's talking to the same database, and then all these crazy ways to try and force, you know, an application to reload its edit, you know, flush its editing context and get things back into memory. But now it does seem that you just ask the database and it will always tell you, and it doesn't let it.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of a function, I guess, of three factors as well, if that makes sense. I mean, the first is how complex operations do you have to perform afterwards on the data before you can send it, right? I mean, obviously, if there's lots and lots of calculations you got to do after getting the data, it might make sense to cache those. And the other factor is how many clients are going to request the exact same data, right? So, I mean, basically, if every client asks for a slightly different location, then all the stuff you cached is sort of useless, right? Because, I don't know, I might make a request based on how I'm standing in front of my house, but 2 minutes later, I already have a different geolocation I'm asking for. So the data you cache that's relevant for in front of my house isn't really going to be helping anyone in the near future doing another request to your server, right?
Right. Yeah, again, for me, it's, and I'm sorry if this is boring, kind of off the topic stuff.
I don't think it's boring.
Out loud about something. Yeah, good. Is it things that I've been thinking about where basically, you know, you tie this with a mapping server, a tile, right? So you request a particular tile, set of tiles corresponding to a geographic location in Google, and then you want to be able to say, bring me very, very quickly points that would fall within this, right? And trying to calculate the least amount of data that you need to be able to say, hey, there is a point that's of interest, but only if a user clicks on it, do you then pull some other data. But in that particular way, you there is a cache to be made for you know, any particular region, and you might even be able to say, hey, if the request is falling in, you know, between this Latin long, you know, large swaths of the earth, you know, the top left-hand corner of the earth, it'll hit this server. And as soon as the user is interested in something else, that they go elsewhere. And that helps you with geographic things. But then if you have time, of course, time could go across any of those different things. So, you know, you might construct two servers or who knows? I mean, it's stuff that's beyond me, but it's still stuff that I struggle with, but because I dream about these things and I'm never quite certain how to make
it. Yeah, and I guess another point could be made that might also depend on location, right? So if you get a query for, say, I don't know, Times Square, that might make more sense to cache because more people are going to request that in the next hour than if you say in Scotty's backyard, right? So you might, I mean, again, that's a factor of, if I cache this data, how many future requests are going to benefit from me caching this, opposed to me having to run new queries for them anyway because my data didn't help them.
Yeah. All right. Well, now I have to do my duty and stop hogging the mic and turn it over to the chat room. And Mr. Graham Lee has to ask the question that we would all expect him to ask, and that is, what type of security features are built in RAM objects, like authentication or access control or encryption? Or is that something that we have to worry about?
No, that's basically sort of plugs where you can take control of that. So there's an authentication mechanism where basically when a request comes to into the server, and you basically for each service you talk to, you can say this service requires authentication or it doesn't. And if it does, then basically any call that goes there just gets sent back to the client, said, hey, you got to log in first. And then the client gets the chance sort of to do a separate login call. Again, that could use any mechanism you please, be just username, password, or something more fancy, like a public key pair, to do the login, and then the next call to that same service again would succeed afterwards. And we also have encryption, of course, and we, both our own using AES, or you can use HTTPS if that's something you want to do. So basically that's both taken care of for you. I mean, you sort of, obviously you got to handle the login yourself. Like, I mean, we're not going to know how you want to verify passwords, right? But sort of that's mm-hmm. sort of plug-in points in the infrastructure where you can just say, okay, this is where I get my username and password. I just want to verify.
So if somebody had made the right decision to use your tools over and Sony, they would not be bowing right now.
I would hope so, yeah. I mean, obviously, I mean, you can always do things wrong, but... And to be honest, I don't know what Sony did wrong, so I can't really comment on whether whatever they did, they could have still made wrong with our tools or not, but...
I think what they did is nothing. They just trusted. I mean, it sounds like, you know, back in the early days of the internet, where you'd have open telnet to all the hosts on the internet, or
right. But you can build the nicest and securest data abstract server, and then if you keep the port to your MySQL database open and the password is password, then we're not going to help you with that, yeah, right?
Right. Okay. Interesting. Are there other questions from the chat room? We'll have to wait 30 seconds before we get to it. And Scotty,
by the way, just for the record, DHM Spectre said that Postgres has a branch that also supports geolocation, in case anyone cares about that. Yeah.
Yeah, John, you're doing a sterling job. In case anyone hasn't noticed, I've basically been... I can't see the chat room. I'm struggling to keep the uploads running. I feel like Scotty on the Enterprise trying to keep the Enterprise at warp factor one in order to get there. And I'm just saying, give me a few more minutes, Captain. Give me a few
you
more minutes.
You have one. I do it in 30 seconds.
But it's I think I've just discovered why we were having problems earlier on when I
didn't stop your porn
another
downloads
machine
or?
In the office. Yeah, well, it's the other way around. There was another machine in the office doing two huge video files going up into Dropbox.
That might do it.
And have you fired the person responsible?
Yeah, I'm now fired.
dumbass.
I didn't realize that machine was still turned on over there. So that could be why we were having lots of problems earlier on. So even though I'd lowered our bandwidth requirements to virtually nothing through the time, our bandwidth would have been virtually nothing. So it was making no difference at all. So there we are. Apologies for that, folks. It's not the only technical problem around here was incompetence.
Well, I would like to point out, by the way, that although I didn't know what a Dalek was, I do know who Scotty on Star Trek is. So. Can I renew some small portion of my geek cred, or I'm wasted?
No, you're wasted. I mean, you know, anybody knows who Scotty on Star Trek is. I don't care. You know, it's anybody. Everybody should know what a Dalek is. There we are. Right. Okay. Right. Oh, yes. They say in the chat room that Simon said on Twitter I was uploading 12 gigabytes of files. I was doing that over the weekend, actually. But today I was merely trying to upload another 7 gigs. So well, trying to broadcast video and audio and do a Skype conversation across my 500 kbs upload channel. So there we go. Right. Okay.
Mark, is
any
there
more
anything
questions?
Else that yeah. we have not asked you that we should have asked?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, it's just like, I don't know, obvious those products have like a huge surface area and lots of different things you can do with them from all sorts of angles. So it's really hard to cover it all.
Well, I'll ask my other stilly question, because you co-founded the company how many years ago was it?
2002, I believe. So that was 9 years ago.
Okay,
yeah.
So almost...
Scary.
Right. And it, yeah. So where do you think you might be in 9 years? I mean, aside from just, you know, going to sleep at night, you know, with large piles of money and many beautiful women.
Oh, I can put you in touch with some Russian brides if you wish.
There we go. No, but I mean,
By the way, Natasha Bagina, she wasn't sure which was best, server or client, for a single source of data truth in syncing situations.
Oh, okay. Well, tell her to listen to the podcast, and she might know afterwards.
Well, yeah, she says, "Look, whichever one, I'm all about servicing the client." So.
Yes, there we are. Do you think I should put the link for the Russian brides in the show notes?
I think there are numerous people. No, okay. So, but you started out in Delphi, and then you kind of moved to .NET, and so back in 2000, you know, 2002, would you have imagined that you would have the portion of business that's related to Objective-C and iOS and macOS? That
oh, definitely not. I mean, let's be honest. Definitely it's not, like the Mac was on the platform. On the horizon as a serious platform at that stage, right.
So what do you think is going to be 9 years from now the platform that you're going to be servicing that you never would have imagined? I mean, are you going to have a bunch of, you know, Palm OS clients?
I have no idea, to be honest. I mean, we're actually looking into adding Java, and we're also working on sort of like better support for like lightweight JavaScript clients, so they actually that does take care of WebOS. So I think we're pretty much covering everything that's out there right now, more or less, or at least we soon will.
What about Ruby or Python as languages, or, you know, is anybody asking you for that or thinking about that? And the reason I ask that is when I think server side these days, I think new one, the decision about which technology and language to do almost is somewhat based on how easy is it to deploy it. So, I mean, if you want to write a Rails app, it's so easy to deploy. Or if you like Python, you can throw something up on Google App Engine.
Yeah, it's not something we're looking at actively right now, to be honest. I mean, basically, I think for the server side, our main story is .NET and Mono. Because with .NET, you can write one server and you can put it on a Mac server, on a Windows server, or on the Linux server. And granted, Mac servers are pretty rare. So I think that's really... That's really, at least right now. I mean, obviously, again, 5 years down the road, let alone 10 years down the road, things might look completely different. But that's sort of what we're focusing on right now for the server platform, and also that helps us, you know, sort of concentrate the development effort to sort of, well, I guess two, because we do support Delphi servers as well. But .NET servers really are sort of the platform where we put in most effort for server side technology. Rather than duplicating that across all the different platforms. While with the client, we really focus on basically every client platform we want to support it natively, right? So we didn't do a badly ported, I know, library you can link somewhat awkwardly into your Objective-C application, but we actually sat down and rewrote Data Abstract client or the SDK client based on our knowledge, obviously, and based on our experience, but we sat down and completely rewrote it in Objective-C to be a proper Objective-C framework. So your classes are going to be called what you expect them in an Objective-C, in a Cocoa-like framework to be called. Your method names are going to be Cocoa-like, things like that. And at the same, now we're porting it to Java, the client. The client is going to look like a Java framework. So if you're a regular Java developer and you're used to how things work, you're going to feel right at home there as well.
So there's not even any shared C code at all between, let's say, that your Windows .NET client and your
no. Basically, they're all three completely, well, Delphi, .NET, and Objective-C are completely separate code bases, each written completely for the platform at hand.
Great. Scotty, I think it may be time for us to bring this ship to base. What do you say?
Bring this what to base?
Ship.
All right, okay. That's fine. I thought you said something else there for a moment. Well, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much for that, Mark. I hope you've enjoyed John asking you questions.
Definitely, yeah. Because,
well, I've been off finding a new bride. Right, we're just going to – we said last week that we would do a WWDC top tip each week. So I hope you've been thinking of one, John. I'll give you just a few moments to think of one. Mark, I think our top tips last week were go and find some food at lunchtime and buy a ticket. So we've been really useful to people going so far. So, John, what is your top tip for WWDC this week?
show Mark some love by when you see him, give him a big hug, take a picture of it, send it to me.
That's two people you've asked to do that now. You're going to have everybody hugging everybody.
Well, I think that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get a critical mass of hugging so that there can be, you know, an adequate distribution of love, because there are many software developers that just don't get enough love in their life. You know, you spend far too much time in Xcode and you wonder, does anybody really love me? And I think that it needs to be made abundantly clear it's not that everybody likes RemObjects. It's that everybody loves RemObjects.
If you don't get enough love, I can put you in touch with some Russian brides. There we are. Mark, do you have a WWDC
top
tip?
My tip would be to go to the Stump the Experts on, I think, Tuesday nights usually. That's sort of like a non-tag session, so many people don't go there, but it's really funny and really entertaining. So I definitely check that out.
Excellent.
Okay, I'll give my more serious one. Come and join Mark and Rainer and whomever else that we managed to put together to do a photographic
walk. Yeah, that's another thing, yeah.
All right, so how do people get details of that, John?
We don't know. I think we haven't announced it yet, but we will figure something out on Twitter and we'll definitely put it up with the WWDC hashtag. Oh, well, so okay. That's the thing. It's like if people don't know that, make sure that they've got their search set up with WWDC hashtag.
Okay, that's good, and we'll talk about that a little bit more maybe next week on the show if you're ready. So that's a photographic walkabout of San Francisco together with other developers just to go take cool photos.
Yep, and Spectre chimed in that since he at Mac India is trying to build a comprehensive list of lunches, activities, little, you know, things that are outside Moscone, outside WWC, he will certainly host it prominently, since it will be the go-to event. I mean, forget the beer bash or anything like that. It's going to be the walkabout. The walkabout's going to be so big that it will take an hour just for the beginning and the end of the line to pass any particular fixed location.
Definitely.
Yeah, I've seen how fast you two walk. Okay, I think my tip is definitely go there with the idea that this is a chance to get to know new people. Even if you're going with other people from your company, or you know, so you're traveling with a gang that you already know about, you know, make a point of saying, yeah, I'm going to find new people to speak to. Find out, you know, watch Twitter with the WWDC hashtag, find out which bars and parties people are hanging out at, and go make new friends. You know, don't be a tech isolated person that just goes to sessions and back to your hotel room, but take the opportunity to really make sure you meet loads of other developers, find out something about them, find out you know, what they're working on, because that's, you know, makes Twitter through the year, where you're just following tweets of people that you now know personally, you've had a beer with, whatever else, you know, a much more personal place than just a bunch of text flying by. That would be my top tip.
You could just go. So you could just go up to somebody, say, "What's your Twitter handle?" And then they'll say, "You know, Mac DevNet. Everybody loves Mac DevNet.
There we are. Right, there we are. That's been. I'm pretty sure that's been an interesting show. The bits I've been managing to listen to have been.
Hopefully you recorded it so you can listen again, right?
Yeah, I'll add it to my iTunes listening list and take a listen to my own show and see what's going on. So, Mark, apologies that you've not had my full attention all of the time, but hopefully John has been a gentleman.
Definitely,
to you.
Yes.
And allowed you to share the stuff you were hoping to share. Thank you once again for being a sponsor of the show. Although this is a non-sponsored show, so we don't want to have any accusations that we're sort of giving the sponsors favors by, you know, having the sponsor on the show talking, though. Just tell us where people can find your stuff and follow you on Twitter and any blog you might
do. Well, you can go to remobjects.com. That's remobjects.com to find pretty much all our stuff. We got trial versions of all our products that you can use to try the thing out for 30 days. You can follow RemObjects on Twitter at RemObjects, or myself at Dwarfland. We got blogs at blogs.remobjects.com. And also we got a big, well, starting to get bigger section of videos out there on our website as well. So check those out as well.
And John, do your bio.
My bio. I was born, dun 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 dun. Then I raised up. Dun, 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 dun. No. You can find all about my product at MemoryMiner at memoryminer.com. You can read my blog at memoryminer.com/blog. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, which you do, I would say that if you're listening to this and you're not following
shame
me on
Twitter,
that I'm not, shame on you, and I'm not getting enough love. So give me love at Djembe, D-J-E-M-B-E. You won't regret it.
Oh, yeah. And follow either John or me to find out about our walkabout.
Exactly.
Can I talk about me now?
Sure, Scotty.
Yeah. I'm Scotty from My Developer TV. You can follow me on Twitter at MacDevNet. And if you really are lonely and looking for a Russian bride, try www.bestrussbrides.com.
Oh my God,
we are.
You did that.
So it is a sponsored show after all.
Yes, yes. This show has been brought to you by Best Russian Brides. And let me read the advert to you. Are you looking for your soulmate? Premium Russian Brides will help you to meet the girl you've been dreaming of. At the site, you will find thousands of profiles of gorgeous Russian ladies. All of them are real and wish to find someone special to spend the rest of their lives with. That's www.bestrussbrides.com. Thank
That's
you very
awesome.
Much. Until next time, you take care.
You too.
Shall I send them a bill?
Definitely.
No, you should just ask for like a free sample for them before you travel. Have a best Russian date
And also, as Kim reminds us, you should mention that sponsor site is not safe for work. Who would have thunk?
Yeah.
It's safe for work. They're all wearing clothes, I think, mostly.
All right.
We'll see. Right, okay. Someone's been trying it. It's your own fault for going to a Russian bride site at work. Come on. You can hardly blame me. I said it's best Russian brides. What do you expect? It's like let's visit, www.uberporn and see if it's safe for work. I have no idea if that's a real site, by the way. Please don't visit it. It's no, I've no idea. I am not responsible for whatever is there. Scroll down, Scotty. There's no clothes there. Well, you don't have to look that far, do you? Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, I haven't even visited the link. There we are. Right. Maybe I do need to edit that. No, it's fine. Let's leave it in there.